There's the coast!
Falzone yelled amid the din of explosions coming from Starseeker's cannon. Bridget and Olney peered in the direction Falzone pointed, spotting the erratic line of Cobaltville sandcats and deathbirds along the broken terrain of the shoreline. Two of the deathbirds lifted from the shore, arcing back over the land briefly, then breaking straight out toward Starseeker.
When we get within their range, we're all chilled.
We're going to be within their range anyway. Get the deck guns ready.
Falzone called out the order, and crews ran to man the 50 cal deck guns.
Their heat seekers aren't going to do them any good, but they still have the nose cannon and rockets.
In seconds, the deathbirds swooped over Starseeker, their blades whipping through the air. Bullets from the chain guns chewed across the deck and punched holes in the sailcloth. Two men fell from the gun crews. Their bodies turned into a series of bloody, ruptured craters by the big rounds. The deck guns never touched either of the two deathbirds. Immediately, the Y2K ships fanned out, intent on turning back and taking advantage of the air cover. The two lead ships spread out, opening overlapping fields of fire. Glancing at the sky, Bridget watched as the pair of deathbirds came back around for another pass. This time, the pilots skimmed even lower, the rotors beating waves across the ocean surface as they swept in to attack. The ladder leading out of the cargo hold led to the stern section amidships, leaving Kane the whole deck to cross between the cannon crews. He glanced back at Grant, unable to speak over the roar of the cannons firing. Grant spoke, and even though Kane couldn't hear him, he could read his friend's lips.
Fucking one percenter.
Kane nodded, knowing the biggest danger they were going to face was the armored magistrates among the Y2K worshippers. Kane waited while the starboard gun crews rolled their cannon back to recharge. Then, while their attention was centered primarily on their weapons, he pushed free of the cargo hold and sprinted. His mind flew, assessing all the variables that suddenly took shape before him, slowing time. He lived on his razor-edged quickness and decisive ability. Some of the portside gun crews spotted him and went for their weapons. Kane brought up the machine pistol he'd accepted from Falzone's stores, firing short bursts as he ran across the reeling deck. Two men went down, then three and four, knocked back over the cannon they were assigned to. Target number five was a worshipper who stepped out in front of Kane. Kane emptied the last of the MP5's clip into the man's mouth, shattering his head and blowing it back over the magistrate trying to get position behind the man. Kane kept running, putting all his strength into his stride, aware that Grant had fired his blaster dry behind him. Kane went low, staying loose, taking the shock of hitting the magistrate on his shoulder. It still felt as if he'd gone head-to-head with an anvil, but the mag dropped to the deck. Off balance, but recovering quickly, Kane pushed himself up, drawing the knife from the sheath on his leg. He wrapped the magistrate on his head with the machine pistol as the man struggled to his knees. When the man's head went backward from the impact, Kane slashed his throat with the knife. Crimson spilled down the front of the polycarbonate armor.
Chill them!
Kane didn't know who shouted the order, but he knew it came from the prow ahead. Letting go of the machine pistol so it hung from the leash around his wrist, he picked up the dying magistrate's copperhead. He wheeled, bringing up the assault rifle, the knife still bloody in his other fist. A Y2K worshipper stood at the top of the prow over the door to the captain's quarters. He swung the 7.62mm machine gun mounted on the deck around in Kane's direction. Domi blasted two other worshippers who fired at them, sending their bodies tumbling away. Grant switched magazines on his machine pistol, his eyes bright with combat heat. He stutter-stepped as a round poured into his thigh, but he remained standing, bellowing in pain and rage. Domi wheeled and cursed, shooting into the center mass of the man that had wounded Grant, putting him down. The copperhead came into Kane's arms like a long-lost lover. His finger caressed the trigger, and a three-round burst took off the top of the Y2K worshipper's head. The corpse stumbled back from the machine gun, even as Kane surged forward again. Kane focused on the door to the captain's quarters.
Grant!
Bullets whizzed around his head, letting him know most of the crew was aware the ship had been invaded.
Yeah,
you got the door!
Grant made no response, but ran headlong for the door. Kane stepped aside, shoving Domi roughly forward after Grant. He jerked Ramar into motion as well. The old man was bleeding from at least two wounds on his arm and shoulder, but was still ready to make a fight of it. The last salvager didn't make it to Kane, going down in a blaze of gunfire. His body hit the deck at Kane's feet, blood spattering the deck from his mouth as he tried to scream. Mind spinning, searching for the edge he needed to keep the rest of his group together, Kane spotted the powder barrels in the cannon pits that were used to reload the artillery. A bullet caught Kane in the left hip, spinning him sideways, but he remained focused on his target. He squeezed the trigger, aiming for the powder keg farthest away from him on the starboard side. The explosion hurled the gun crew in all directions and spread flames throughout the sails and rigging. The concussion knocked Kane off balance, but he kept his feet. Grant reached the door to the captain's quarters, paused momentarily, then drew back and drove a shoulder against the door. The lock gave with a shriek that was heard even above the next powder keg exploding in the gun pits. Debris filled the air, jagged pieces of railing and deck, chunks and hunks of men's bodies, and cannonballs rolled loose as well. Grant shoved inside the captain's quarters with Domi on his heels. Kane drove Ramar forward, throwing both of them through the door and falling to the floor as bullets followed them. They slid across the floor. Kane kicked the door closed, watching as it sagged a little on its hinges, but the wood was thick enough to hold out the bullets for a moment. He glanced around the room, seeing only that it was empty, thinking that they were well and truly fucked, that Mallet had moved the girl somewhere and Lakesh hadn't caught it.
Here.
Grant reached under the bed. Ariel came reluctantly at first, then she wrapped her arms around Grant's thick neck.
Ramar!
Ariel saw the old man.
I want my mommy!
I know, child. Gonna get you there in just a little bit. You just sit tight.
Kane stood and peered through the crack between the door and door frame. Fires had spread across the ship's deck from the gun crew pits. They'd lost at least four or five of them, including the crews, but the smoke from the burned gunpowder and the fires made that end of the ship cloudy.
We got girl. Now what?
I don't know. This is the part I was going to figure out when we got here.
We here?
Damn. And here I was thinking I needed to check the map again.
Not funny. Feel like rat, all trapped. Nowhere to go.
Without warning, 50 cal bullets chewed through the door, ripping free long splinters and digging into the wall on the opposite side of the room. Grant dropped to the floor with Ariel, who put her hands over her ears.
Mallet, you're gonna get the girl chilled!
A man in mag black strode from the swirling smoke at the ship's stern. He turned and popped his sin-eater free, taking instant aim on the man firing the 50 cal machine gun. He fired at once, ripping the man's face to shreds.
Hold your fire! Next man that fires without my order, I'll chill myself!
Blaster fire ceased immediately.
Get those damn fires put out!
Mallet pointed to the starboard side of the ship. Kane cautiously surveyed the deck that he could see. Chaos ruled aboard the ship. Although the exploding powder kegs hadn't caused extensive structural damage, they had blown the hell out of the ship. And although Mallet still wasn't aware of it, his ship was still sinking. Kane could already feel the ship rolling heavier with all the extra water it had taken on.
Give up the girl, Kane!
Let us go free if we do?
Hell no!
Don't see why I should do it, then.
That way she gets to live. You obviously want her to live. You went to all this trouble to come find her.
I've always been more concerned about my own neck. That's what they teach you as a magistrate. You know that. A dead magistrate is just worm food. But a live one is a weapon of the Baron, just waiting to be used again.
Kane scanned the room, thinking quickly, trying to find some way out of their predicament. The little girl clung fearfully to Grant, shaking.
What, Mommy? What, Mommy?
I'll give you a quick... clean death. I'll promise you that.
Kane remembered the tortured bodies of the dead men he and Grant had found in the pass when they linked up with Ramar to begin the journey to the Northwest Territories. He knew that Mallet wasn't one to let death be easy when it didn't have to be.
Kane!
I'm thinking.
Kane heard Deathbird chain guns and cannon in the distance and knew that Bridget and Falzone were obviously under attack as well. Time was running out for all of them. Forcing herself to wait, blowing her breath out to keep from hyperventilating, Bridget watched the lead death bird scream by overhead, trying not to think about the dead and wounded men the chain guns left in their wake. Then she stepped out and brought up her machine pistol, aiming for the rear rotor, the weakest part of the aircraft. Her finger tightened on the trigger, firing through the whole clip. The bullet struck the rotor, doing enough damage to destroy it. The pilot fought for control, but just couldn't get the death bird back. The aircraft plunged to the sea, the whirling blades breaking into shrapnel as they struck the water. The pieces chopped into the cockpit, starting an explosion that ripped through the craft. The death bird sank in seconds. A brief flurry of cheering ripped raggedly from the throats of the crew, but it was quickly drowned out when they noticed two more death birds streaking for them from the coast.
They see the other ships now. They know it's more than just us.
As she reloaded, Bridget glanced back to the west and saw Falzone's other ships sailing toward them.
Going to be too little. Way the hell too late.
Falzone's voice had gone raw and dead ever since the explosions aboard Mallet's ship. He'd lost hope.
It's never too late.
Bridget was surprised at her own stubbornness.
Kane will never give up.
For all you know, Kane's already dead.
No, he's alive. If he were dead, I'd know it. And if he's alive, I'm willing to bet your daughter is alive too.
Starseeker's deck guns came to life, and Bridget glanced up to see Mac Olney manning the one mounted in the stern. The withering barrage of fire turned the approaching death bird aside for the moment, but there was no mistaking the other two wasp shapes that hurtled slightly above the ocean surface at them.
Look, planes!
Bridget turned and glanced into the sky, shading her eyes against the harsh sun. It took her a moment to find them, even with them being crimson against the cerulean sky. There were a dozen planes, grouped in threes, flying Point and two wingmen.
Wei Kiang's people made it.
Bridget smiled. Falzone, the Tong are wanting to know when they can start attacking the ships.
Not until I know Kane and my daughter are clear of them. Tell them to take out the beach units.
Even farther behind the approaching salvage ships was a large navy of red lacquered warships flying Imperial Dragon flags. Bridget glanced back at Mallet's ship. It was still swaddled in black smoke that obscured the view of much of the deck. But somewhere on that ship, she knew Kane still lived and fought.
Kane!
Kane ignored the man for the moment, gazing at the floor of the captain's quarters. The cargo hold lay below. He glanced up at Grant.
Rip that bed out of the wall and turn it over.
Over the long years they'd been together, Grant knew better than to question. He passed Ariel to Ramar, who talked to her like a grandpa at a Sunday dinner, keeping himself and the little girl calm.
Turn the bed on its side. We're gonna need it for protection.
Those 50 cal rounds will chew right through the bed.
Grant ripped the structure from the wall.
Kane!
We won't be here then.
Kane took the small block of Plasex he had at his belt. Explosives were always good to have, he'd learned, and he hadn't hesitated about taking them when he'd found them in Falzone's armory. He pinched off a chunk of the gray-white clay-like material, then flattened it against the floor. He glanced at Domi and Ramar.
Get behind the bed.
Kane added a remote-control detonator to the Plasex, then joined the others.
Answer me, Kane!
Pull the mattress tight.
Kane turned to Ramar.
Cover her ears.
Ramar did as he was told, hunkering his own good ear deep into his shoulder. Kane touched the remote control detonator, setting off the charge. Trapped in the room as it was, the explosion was hellishly loud. The concussive force rocked them all back against the wall. Kane's head hit so hard he had black spots in his vision and felt as if he were waking up from a deep sleep. Grant kicked the mattress away. When it fell to the floor, the mattress was shredded on one side from the force of the blast, and smoldering pockets clung to the material. The blast had opened the floor, though, leaving a hole nearly 5 feet across and cracks that split the deck boards. Jagged, splintered ends surrounded the hole. Kane shone his flash into the hold, finding the water-covered floor just over 20 feet below. He glanced at Grant.
You first, then Domi. She protects you while I lower the little girl to you.
Grant nodded, then levered himself over the side of the hole, dropping and rolling when he hit. He was on his feet instantly, reaching up for Domi. Once Domi was safely on her feet, he reached up for the little girl. Kane eased the little girl down as far as he could, then dropped her the rest of the way.
Move! Get her to the sub!
Domi had her blaster up and firing, proof that at least part of the crew had been sent below decks to either check on the leak or possibly to shoot up into the floor under the captain's quarters. An onslaught of 50 cal rounds suddenly burst through the door, tearing away a third of it. Kane and Ramar hugged the floor.
Shit! We're getting down to the bone on this one, Kane.
Kane grabbed the old man's hand.
Go. I'll catch up.
I could stay.
The 50 cal rumbled again, spitting more bullets into the room.
Stay and do what? Catch the last train west?
Kane shook his head.
I'm not staying here for that.
See you on the other side of it, then.
You will.
Kane held the old man's hand as far into the hold as he could, then let it go. Grant was wading through waist-deep water, heading for the hole that had been cut through the hull.
Hold up! I'm throwing my blaster out!
Mallet gave the order to cease fire. Kane worked quickly, smashing the last of the Plasex along the copperhead's buttstock so it wouldn't be very noticeable. Then he added a remote detonator.
Kane!
Standing, gazing through the huge hole left by the 50 cal rounds, Kane studied the deck. Men were shifting, and the way they watched let him know some of them were already crawling on top of the captain's quarters. But beyond them, he spotted the red air wags and tall ships of the Tong. Wei Kiang had delivered after all.
Looks like you may not win this one. If you're interested, I'll accept a surrender.
Fuck you, Kane! You're a dead man!
Kane opened the door wide enough to kick the copperhead through, praying the Plasex and detonator stayed on the weapon and was operable. The assault rifle skidded to a stop amidships, 30 feet from Mallet.
Now come out!
Kane spun away from the doorway and dropped, catching himself briefly on the edges of the hole in the floor. Splinters tore at his hands and fingers. Then he dropped the rest of the way into the hole. He collapsed, letting his legs go limp under him because he didn't want to take a chance on breaking an ankle. He came up on his knees, sputtering, the cold water already up to his chin. He got his bearings, noticing the men running down the companionway alongside the hold. Grant, Domi, Ramar, and the little girl were gone. If their luck held, Teresa would have the mini-sub within easy reach because none of them would be able to find the abandoned scuba gear in the water. The only thing that concerned Kane were the sharks. If Teresa wasn't waiting, it was a sure bet the sharks were. Kane raised the machine pistol from the water and aimed at the men running down the companionway. Squeezing the trigger, he sent three of them spinning, dropping into the water that now filled the hold and was still rising. Kane dodged to the side as muzzle flashes flared from the cargo hold entrance in the deck. He heard Mallet screaming orders. Then Kane was underwater, shoving a hand up only long enough to trigger the detonator. The deck above him went to pieces, creating a hole nearly 20 feet across. It opened up near the stern, well away from where he'd dropped the copperhead. The assault rifle had either slid or someone had picked it up and moved it. As the deck above crashed into the cargo hold, propelled by the Plas-X knocking everything down, light also filled part of the ship's interior. Water ran between the boxes, crates, extra sailcloth, and equipment. Bodies floated on the water, torn and bloodied, most of them not even whole, some of them with broken sections of plank driven through them. And through the hole in the deck, Kane saw a few death birds being hunted by three and four times as many of Wei Qiang's red-lacquered airwags. The Tong craft were little more than flying coffins, holding no armor at all, crafted of light wood and canvas, and powered by small engines. Still, they came equipped with machine guns and hand-thrown bombs. Even all of the Cobaltville magistrates with sandcats and deathbirds couldn't stand against that kind of consistent, suicidal pressure Wei Qiang commanded from his troops. The ship lurched suddenly as the cargo hold full of water caused it to shift. Kane threw himself into the water. It was deep enough to swim easily in the cargo hold now. He knew if he didn't get out of the dying ship quickly enough that he would go down with it, pulled to the bottom by the undertow. It took him two tries to find the opening that had been cut in the bottom of the ship. He blew out his breath, filling his lungs with fresh air. There was every possibility that Teresa would have left once she had her daughter on board. Kane hoped that she hadn't. A crate floated toward him, a body bobbing next to it. Kane shoved the crate away, getting ready to dive through the opening in the hull. Then Mallet rose up from the water, looking like a wild man. Kane grabbed the mag's wrist, then stepped inside the man's defense and headbutted him. Balling his right fist, Kane drove a short jab into Mallet's neck beneath the helmet, hoping to catch the man full in the throat and break his trachea. Mallet dodged, turning his head and taking a blow along his jaw. He backhanded Kane in the face, nearly knocking him down and freeing the sinew. Kane maintained his hold on the mag weapon, knowing he was dead if he lost it. Blood trickled across his lips from his nose. His vision blurred for a moment from the pain.
Gonna die, Kane.
Mallet drew back his fist and drove it toward Kane's face. Unwilling to release his hold on Mallet's sinew, Kane dodged, feeling Mallet's fist skim along the side of his face, tearing at his ear. Kane raised his knee, driving it into Mallet's crotch, but the polycarbonate armor kept the blow from being debilitating. Mallet swung again and howled with rage. The blow caught Kane on top of the shoulder, briefly numbing his arm. Kane drew his knife and stabbed at Mallet's throat, expecting the man to dodge back from the blade. Instead, Mallet turned to face the knife, catching the point on the helmet's face shield. The blade was sharp enough that it embedded in the shield, sending fracture lines skating across the material. Kane drew the knife back and plunged it into the man's face again and again, splintering the shield, knocking jagged pieces free. Suddenly, one bloodshot eye was open to Kane's attack. Before Kane could ram the blade home, the ship lurched again, sinking quickly in the stern. The floor tilted treacherously. Off balance, unable to get secure footing due to buoyancy from the water flooding the cargo hold and the slippery wood, Kane fell, pulling the sin-eater into line. Mallet fired immediately. One of the bullets hit Kane on his lower left side, just under the ribs. White-hot pain seared through his mind, but he knew he was lucky because the wound was through and through the flesh and didn't bounce off the ribs where it could have fractured bones or been deflected internally. Kane dived instantly, listening to the bullets splat against the water and watching some of them leave streamers in the water only inches away. With the sunlight pouring down through the huge hole ruptured in the ship's deck, the hole in the hull was easier to find. Staying underwater, Kane swam for the hole. He felt the water pushing at him as he neared the breach, continuing to stream into the cargo ship. He fought it, managing to swim strongly enough to catch the edges of the hole. Just as he started to pull himself through, something seized his ankle. Clinging to the hole, fighting the pull of the waters rushing in and the grip on his ankle, Kane glanced back and saw Mallet rip his own knife free. Kane lashed out with his free foot, stomping into Mallet's helmet hard enough to break the man's grip. Kane pulled himself through the hole, his lungs already aching for oxygen. He stared down through the water, spotting the mini-sub 30 feet below, spotting Grant, Domi, Ramar, and Teresa through the plexiglass nose. Grant was shouting and pointing to Kane's left. Turning in the indicated direction, Kane spotted the large, muty shark cruising effortlessly through the water over 40 yards away. The creature came around serenely, its black eye focusing on Kane. The cruel mouth gaped open to reveal huge teeth. Then it felt like a burning brand lay along Kane's jaw. Murky red blood stained the water near Kane's face, letting him know he'd been cut. He flared out instinctively, moving away from the broad blade that flashed in the water. He turned over and found Mallet coming straight for him, knife poised to strike again. Kane blocked his attacker's knife wrist, peering through the shattered remnants of the face shield. Only cold, naked fury showed in Mallet's gaze. Throwing punches underwater was almost impossible, but the knives were pure death. Kane thrust at Mallet's face, but the Mag Commander turned his head and blocked the blow with his helmet. From the corner of his eye, feeling as though his lungs were going to explode, Kane saw the shark swimming toward them. Mallet hadn't seemed to notice the creature at all, intent on killing Kane. Mallet lunged, jabbing his knife at Kane's face. Blood continued to flow from the wound on Kane's jaw, streaming into the water and clouding his vision. He pulled himself inside Mallet's reach, barely avoiding the knife. Then he threw his left arm out, locking it around and behind Mallet's right arm, trapping it and preventing him from using the knife again. Mallet struggled to get free, lifting his legs and driving his boots against Kane's thighs, fighting to be free. Dizzy from exertion and the lack of oxygen, Kane held on stubbornly. The cargo ship pulled at him as it sank lower in the water, now headed for the bottom far below. He and Mallet remained just beyond the tug of the undertow claiming the ship. The shark swam faster now, coming straight at them. Kane focused on the savage creature, kicking out, wishing he had the swim fin still, willing himself to survive. Drawn by Kane's intent gaze, Mallet stopped struggling long enough to glance back over his shoulder. By that time, the shark was already on them. Horror filled Mallet's face as he realized what was happening. He screamed, air bubbles exploding from his mouth and through the shattered faceplate. Then the shark took him, locking onto his midsection because he was between the creature and Kane. The shark ripped Mallet from Kane's grip, stripping him like a toy from a child. Caught by the slipstream of the muty shark's passage, Kane twisted and flailed, then slammed up against the creature's body. He recovered quickly, watching as the shark bit down, cracking the polycarbonate armor easily. Bits and pieces of Mallet floated down and away as the shark closed its mouth. A blood fog foamed from the shark's mouth. Mallet's legs kicked until one of them fell off and began the long, slow descent to the ocean floor. Before it could go far, however, another shark swooped in and snatched it up. Then came at Kane. Galvanized into action, Kane swam for the rear of the mini-sub, kicking strongly, not knowing if he had enough speed and strength and air to make it. He felt the shark closing in on him, sensing the great creature's full attention. Then he saw Grant drop into the water from the rear of the mini-sub, leveling a spear gun. When Grant fired, the spear missed Kane by inches, darting by his face. Keeping focused on the mini-sub, knowing he'd be aware of the moment the shark got him, Kane surprised himself when he reached Grant. Glancing over his shoulder, Kane spotted the shark behind him, swimming away from the mini-sub now, a spear protruding from its head. Lungs near bursting, vision filled with black spots, Kane swam up under the mini-sub and pulled himself through the hatch. Kane didn't have the strength to haul himself up at first. Ramar grabbed him by the back of the wetsuit and pulled him aboard. Sucking air gratefully, Kane fell to the mini-sub's deck and lay there, his hands over his head to open his lungs better. Teresa sat in the pilot's seat with Ariel held protectively in her lap. The little girl held tightly to her mother. Grant came in through the hatch, then reached down to help Kane to his feet.
Yeah, you're cut up some.
I've been worse.
Domi rummaged through a first aid kit.
Get us topside. It looked like Kang and his forces had everything well in hand, but I want to be on hand to help out.
As Teresa brought the mini-sub around, Kane watched the darkening sea drink down the broken cargo ship, streaming debris and corpses in its wake. Epilogue. Kane surveyed the rocky coastline as he carried the 7.62mm machine gun he'd salvaged toward the nearest longboat Falzone had assigned to ferry recovered items to the waiting cargo ships. His face still hurt where Mallet had cut him. The battle between the Koboldville magistrates, Falzone's people, and the Tong had raged for nearly 2 hours after the Tong had arrived. For the first 30 minutes, the engagement had been vicious and bloody, with both sides throwing everything they had into it. Then both sides had pulled back to a degree, jockeying for position. In the end, the Tong's disposable aircraft had proved the turning point. Some of the sandcats destroyed along the beach still burned. A few corpses of death birds and their crews lay shattered across the rocky beachfront, but there were even more of the canvas and red lacquer airwags Kang had called on to be sacrificed in the battle. Terns and gulls were already working over the corpses, and crabs crawled over the bodies lying at the water's edge. The sea had taken everyone that had gone into it. Falzone and the Tong members maintained an uneasy alliance, and Kane knew if the Tong warlord hadn't needed or wanted the information so badly from Falzone, they'd probably all be dead now. At least, they wouldn't be scavenging parts from the abandoned sandcats and deathbirds, or stripping weapons and extra ammo from the dead that had been left behind. Kane placed the machine gun into the longboat.
You look like you could use a rest.
Turning, Kane saw Bridget Baptiste approaching with her arms full of med supplies raided from the sandcats. Smoke and soot stained her face, and the honey-gold hair was disheveled.
I'll be fine.
You always are.
Bridget placed the med supplies in the longboat.
I've got some self-heats from the ship's stores up on the hill.
She pointed to a copse of trees on a ridge 40 feet up the hillside.
It's not a banquet, but it'll be hot.
Kane's first reaction was to turn her down. During the salvaging operation, she'd been hanging around Mac Olney, the Heimdall Foundation man. Or maybe he'd been hanging around her.
What about Olney?
Bridget looked up at him.
What about him?
Kane stopped himself short of saying something they'd both regret.
All right.
All right?
Bridget lifted an eyebrow.
The self-heats. Something was said about a rest.
Bridget nodded and led the way, following a game trail up the side of the hill to the ridge. As Kane sat on the ground, he was suddenly aware of how dirty and blood-covered he was. He wished he'd thought to clean up. Sitting on the ridge, he could peer out over the battlefield, another in a long list of ones he'd seen. None of them were forgettable. The slapping crush of the waves rolling in over the rocks sounded peaceful. The voices of the men working below, speaking English and Chinese, reached his ears, punctuated by the cries of the seabirds. Despite the death and destruction lying at the bottom of the ridge, the sky and sea met in a gauzy haze of blues and gray-green in the distance. The salt air came in thick and heavy, mixed with burned rubber and death smells. It wasn't a picnic spot, and had only a view of hell. Bridget passed out the self-heats, then surprised him with a bottle of wine.
One of the sand cats. I claimed it as part of a personal salvage.
A memory touched Kane then and turned him cold. In one of those other lives that he could barely remember sharing with Bridget, if at all wasn't something drawn strictly from his imagination, she'd said goodbye to him forever over a bottle of wine. He couldn't remember where they'd been or why the decision had been made. She poured the wine into two plastic cups. Kane breathed the aroma in, finding it sharp and sour and pungent. He sipped, and it tasted bitter but good at the same time.
What are you going to do now?
Stay here a couple days, work with Falzone, help him get back on his feet. Then Grant, Domi, and I are going to head back to the Cerberus Redoubt.
Why? Falzone would welcome you with open arms.
Kane shook his head.
This is their place, Baptiste. It isn't mine. I know that, whether Falzone wants to admit it or not.
He could use you.
Yeah, probably. But I've got my own path to find.
And where will that take you?
I don't know, Baptiste. I only know that this isn't it.
Lakesh wants to talk to you soon.
A wolfish smile touched Kane's lips.
Let him stew for a while. It won't hurt him.
He lied to you about this, you know. He lied to all of us.
That's his way. For better or worse, that's Lakesh's way of dealing with things.
So you're going to stay with him?
For now. But he knows he's really stretched things thin between all of us this time.
This could be a good place to settle down.
I'm not ready for that.
Kane glanced at her, feeling his stomach tighten as he asked the question he was afraid of.
What about you, Baptiste? Are you going to stay here? Olney doesn't seem like he'd mind.
Olney's a good man, I think.
Kane nodded, not trusting his throat for a moment.
I think so too.
And if I chose to stay?
Bridget locked eyes with his.
That would be your choice, Baptiste. Personally, I can think of worse places to be.
Kane meant it, but he hated saying it. Bridget sipped her wine and looked out at the battlefield.
I can't.
Her reply surprised him.
You could if you wanted to.
She shook her head, no longer looking at him, wrapping her arms around her legs.
I'm afraid.
Of what?
Wanting something I'm not ready for.
What do you think you're not ready for?
Someone like Alny. Someone who would want me to build my life around his.
Would that be such a bad thing?
He nodded toward Falzone and Teresa, who had staked out a small section of the beach away from the dead. They sat talking quietly, watching Ariel occasionally building a sandcastle and running barefoot through the white-foamed waves.
They seem to make it work.
It's not that easy, Kane, and you know it.
If you worked at it hard enough, maybe it could become easy.
Bridget laughed, but tears splashed on her sunburned cheeks.
Work hard to make something easy? Only you would look at it like that.
Everything easy was hard once. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth doing.
I'm going back to the Cerberus Redoubt, too.
Kane's stomach muscles unclenched slightly, and he breathed more easily.
Okay.
Then, before he could stop himself, he added,
I'm glad, Bridget.
Don't be. Because if the time should come and things feel right, I'll go, Kane. Never mistake that.
I know.
And if she did, he knew that he would miss her. Quietly, he dug into the self-heat, not even really aware of what it was, just enjoying the company. For however long it lasted.
Outlander's Sargasso Plunder is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2001, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2004, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, and Kate Torrey. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Terrence Aselford. The Outlanders theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Deathlands 51, Rat King. Mildred sat back and looked out of the window at the freeway beyond the hospital entrance. All of a sudden, she felt so lonely. Everyone out there seemed so carefree, so untroubled by an invasion of possibly hostile cells within their own body.
Mildred?
Huh?
She turned back to the doctor opposite her. Strange, but he seemed to know her well, judging by his attitude. Yet she couldn't remember ever seeing him before.
I'm sorry. I was just...
He nodded in a typically medical manner. So understanding, yet also so impersonal.
Don't worry about it, Mildred. It won't be a difficult procedure. In fact, we could do it right now.
Before Mildred had a chance to react, he pressed a buzzer on his desk, and the oak double doors behind her swung open. She spun in her chair to see, with some shock, a fully operational surgery in the room she was sure had been a reception area when she came in.
Wait a second here. Don't rush me on this.
She stopped dead. The doctor was dressed in a surgeon's gown, but instead of a surgical mask and cap, he was wearing a Ku Klux Klan hood.
You're not getting your hands on me, motherfucker!
She sprang to her feet, but any attempts to escape were stalled by the iron grip of two men who appeared behind her, seemingly from nowhere, to grasp her firmly by the arms. Glancing over her shoulder, she could see that both men also wore surgical gowns and Klan hoods.
What the fuck?
We're simply going to remove your cyst, Mildred. But as you may have a reaction to the anesthetic, we're going to dispense with it.
Mildred felt a cold sweat break out down her spine. They were going to operate without an anesthetic. For the fun of it. The shock would probably kill her. The two men dragged her into the operating room and pulled her onto the operating table. Not for one second did they release their grip. Mildred tried to struggle as she was hauled across the table, but to no avail. They remained completely implacable.
You bastards!
When she was on the table, one of them took full control of her, holding her down with incredible strength, while the other secured her hands and feet with restraining straps. She kicked out at him, catching him under the chin and snapping his head back with a force that should have rendered him unconscious. He didn't even pause in his actions.
Ain't that a bitch?
With the black woman secured on the table, the doctor walked into the operating room with an almost obscenely casual air. He was carrying a tar and gas torch. She could tell by the mixed odor in the otherwise sterile atmosphere. The sweat gathered in a tiny pool at the small of her back. The smell of the torch reminded her of her father and the way he burned inside his church. She could imagine him, praying for his soul as the Klansmen gathered outside, watching the building burn. She could imagine his prayers, desperate for his own life, but still pleading for forgiveness against the scum who were killing him slowly and painfully. With a flick of an expensive gold lighter, the doctor lit the torch. The heat was noticeable even from several yards.
If we're not going to use an anesthetic, least we can do is cauterize the wound.
One of the others picked up a scalpel and advanced toward her. He ripped off her clothes and poised the scalpel, which caught the light of the torch and flickered over her. Mildred, knowing she was completely powerless and doomed, gave in to her frustration and fear.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.